Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So delighted to be joined in the line by Hugo Southwell, owner of the most cultured left boot in all of Scottish rugby. Hugo, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Very well, despite the situation, very well.
And how is isolation treating you at the moment? What's your current setup?
Well, I'm working from home, like I would say the majority of the population. It's been, as it has been for a lot of people, a very tough time business-wise, but obviously that's the least of everyone's concerns with what's going on with everyone's health. But, you know, I'm at home, I'm working from home up in Edinburgh. Obviously the businesses are based down in Braintree near Stansted, so not much time to haven't had the opportunity to get down there for obvious reasons. We've effectively been closed, I would guess, for 8 weeks now because of non-essential business, but hopefully we'll be starting to properly open up soon with what we do.
So for people who don't know, what do you call your career nowadays?
The majority of my time is taken up working as a sales director and sort of part running a couple of businesses. We launched a business called Trust UK Mobile Billboards about 5 years ago, actually a year after I finished playing, so in May 2015, we launched this business, and it was a guy I'd known for years, actually I'd played cricket with in my year out. From school and university, I played cricket with him in Cape Town, and he was a Dutch guy. The Dutch Academy, without going too much into detail, Dutch Academy were touring. They were there just to have a few 3 weeks of nets and experience in South Africa, and they suddenly realised, well, we brought 9 guys out here. Let's try and get another couple of guys to join the Dutch Academy and have a few games against some local South African sides. So I soon became a Dutch Academy cricket player and joined those guys. Lived with one of them for a while. While I was out there, and got to know this guy Henk Mol very well. He actually played cricket for Holland in the World Cup.
Wow!
Back in the day, and now business partners. And his boss in Holland asked him 5 years ago to franchise the business in the UK, and he came to me to join forces to set this up. So we launched that 5 years ago.
And are you able to do that from? Are you based in Edinburgh now? Is that where you do sort of operate out of?
Yeah, based in Edinburgh, and travel down probably at the moment, obviously not at all, but yeah. Normally before COVID-19 struck, I was probably going down twice a month to London, either for meetings or to just to check in. So yeah, but I am able I was based down in London after I finished playing for a year and a half while we sort of set up the business. And as the business sort of started to get a bit of traction, I was able to relocate up to Edinburgh and sort of travel from here. So, you know, it suits everyone, suits the family. Kids are all obviously at school up here and loving it. So, yeah, it works really well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, during this period, how much have you been missing rugby as just you know, a distraction that you forget how much you'd love almost during this kind of period?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing I miss from rugby, I miss obviously playing. You know, I've grown up playing sport my whole life, and I was in the garden. I was in the garden tonight giving my daughter a golf lesson. She was absolutely loving it. But no, I love my sport, and I do miss. Miss playing rugby. I miss most of all, and you know, people who've played rugby will sympathise with this. It's the camaraderie. It's the day to day banter. It's the going in, and you know, yes, work after rugby. You know, brings its own satisfaction, but you don't quite have the same relationships necessarily with your colleagues that you would with your rugby mates, and you know, that's something you can sort of never underestimate, and never really get back. But obviously, you form close friendships, close relationships, and those are still strong in the years to come. So, you know, that's the main thing I miss. I obviously miss playing, but my body was telling me at the time that it was definitely time to stop.
And how long ago was it that you've had the boots hung up? No.
So I was obviously finished at Wasps in 2014, but I actually got injured in 2013, the summer of 2013, and retired in April 2014. That year was my third year at Wasps, and I just never really managed to. I was in pre-season training and was doing some training, which is never a good idea, with Tom Vandell and Christian Wade, you know, two probably the fastest guys at the time in the Premiership, and obviously the old guy trying to keep up never really was going to work, and managed to pop my hamstring. At the time, it didn't feel too bad. I'd sort of it was a proximal tendon tear, so the inside tendon that attaches to your pelvis was sort of two-thirds frayed, but it never actually popped off. Some people, like Paul O'Connell, obviously retired from this sort of thing where he ruptures hamstring completely, and we've seen, you know, like Mark Bennett obviously went through a brutal hamstring injury as well. But the age that I was at and the fact that it hadn't ruptured completely, the only way they were going to be able to repair it, they said, was by taking it off and putting it back on, so taking my hamstring off completely and reattaching it, which obviously had complications at the age that I was at, 33, 34. So they sort of advised on medical grounds that it was probably time to give it. I mean, I was never quick anyway, so God knows how slow I would have come back after a ruptured hamstring. So it was time to call it a day.
Yeah, fair play. And at that point, had you ever thought about like carrying on in a coaching capacity or anything, or was that just sort of like, you know, drawing a line under rugby at that point?
I actually coached a bit at Roslyn Park when I was injured. I enjoyed it. My biggest reason for not going into coaching, and it was 100% a decision in my head that I was happy with, was I just didn't want to. I'd moved around a bit. You know, I'd been in France. I'd been in Edinburgh obviously for 8 or 9 years. I then went to Wasps, and I felt as a family. I had two kids by the time I'd finished playing, and I felt I owed it to my family to move somewhere, to settle down.
Yeah.
You know, as a coach, as we know, it's probably even more fickle than being a player. And you know, you can be loved 1 minute and hated the next, and it could be that you'd be 2 years here, 2 years there. And for me, that just didn't seem fair. I wanted my young family to be able to settle somewhere and you know, closer to family. We had a house in Edinburgh. We'd always been renting in places on the move, and you know, to be able to go back to a house that we had in Edinburgh was quite a nice thing. And you know, we're settled here now. The kids are all at the same school, and hopefully could be till they're 18, and we don't potentially have to move them from there. So it's a nice place to be, having had the sort of instability that you might have got from coaching.
For sure. So Wasps was the end of a, you know, like a long and pretty varied career. But maybe I can sort of take you back to your first memories of just, you know, picking up a rugby ball and where you started to, you know, develop that love of the game from.
Well, it's an interesting one. People always talk to me about this, and rugby was never ever. And I don't mean this, and I don't want to put a dampener on this on this sort of Q&A as such,
yeah,
on this podcast. But rugby was never my passion. I mean, I came quite late to, I'd always played rugby. I played rugby through school. I played it growing up. I obviously played mini rugby and stuff. And yes, I had a passion for it, but I had a passion for every single sport. I mean, you know, I remember being in hospital when I was eight, and I had an operation when I was eight, and I was staying in the hospital, and the doctors came up and said, oh, you know, the nurses came up and said, well, can we put something on the TV for you? And I said, yeah, can you put the darts on? And I think they thought, you know, an eight-year-old wanted to watch the darts. It was not because I actually thought the darts was the most exciting thing, but I just any sport that was on TV, anything, yeah, that I could watch sports-wise, I would. And you know, I was outside the whole time. I spent my whole youth in the garden playing football, cricket, rugby, wherever I get my hands on. So I guess what I'm saying on that is I didn't really have a love for, my passion, I suppose, at the time, and the sport that as a kid I was best at was cricket.
Right.
And I grew up, you know, playing through the age groups of Sussex all the way through to second team, and didn't quite pull off a contract with Sussex. And rather than at the time thinking, right, I'm going to go and try another county, I was quite sort of, you know, typical teenager, bit peed off with the situation. It was like, oh yeah, well, if Sussex aren't going to give me a contract, I'm not going to continue with this. So I decided, right, I'm at university, and obviously university culture is very much based around more based around rugby, especially in back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago,
sure,
like 20 years ago now actually, and so obviously I got more into my rugby at university, and it got spotted at university, playing the varsity game, Bristol varsity game, and that was it. Went to Worcester on trial during my finals at UE at Bristol, and got awarded a contract at Worcester, and that's when I played with Craig Chalmers, met Craig Chalmers there.
Right.
We had a year together, and he suggested, you know, I had nothing to lose. Worcester, my first year at Worcester was great, but I still felt a bit of a uni student playing rugby.
Sure.
I was still sort of out on a Wednesday night, you know, enjoying life, but not really sort of fully engaged in what professional rugby was all about quite yet. But obviously still, when I got the opportunity, you know, did what I could. And Craig introduced me, Ben, to Frank Haddon. Obviously he was the Edinburgh coach at the time. And, you know, went up there on trial, and the rest was history. It was, you know, I had an amazing time there, right from day one. Playing with, if you remember back then, you know, some of the best players that probably ever wore the Edinburgh jersey, in Tom, sure, Blackadder and Brendan Laney and Derek Lee and guys like Chris Patterson, obviously Mossy, you know, grew to play alongside for many years. So it was a baptism of fire, but it was something that, yeah, it was the best thing I've ever done.
For sure. And I mean, you mentioned all those sort of, you know, proper Edinburgh legends. You know, what were your sort of earliest memories from your time there? Was it sort of intimidating coming up there as like a kind of a younger guy? You know, how did you find it from the start?
It's a funny thing. I didn't, when I was younger, when I was growing up, 18, 19, 20, and I guess people, you know, it depends how you deal with the pressure at different stages of your career. But I suppose that when I got to the age, I didn't start professional rugby until I was 22. So,
right.
So for me, I felt I was almost in a stage where there was, it might seem that at 22 there's more pressure on you, but for me I felt like there was less pressure. I felt like I'd matured a bit more than if you start rugby or start at 18, 19 and you're trying to, you know, be the young gun coming into the team. There is quite a lot of pressure on you. Plus, you know, the guys that I was playing with were, I mean, I couldn't have been welcomed into the team any better. I mean, if you look back in that era of what we did, obviously we had a very good team, but we also, you know, competed regularly in Europe, as we did that year when we got to the quarterfinals, and beat to lose in the group stages, but then lost in the quarterfinals away in the football stadium there. But yeah, we had a very good team. We had some absolute quality players, and we had some brilliant blokes as well. And I think that made it very much more easy that when I came up here, it just felt so natural, and I didn't ever feel pressurised by my teammates, who are the main people you're trying to perform for. If your teammates and ultimately, you know, yourself, after that, and I didn't feel pressurised because everyone was so welcoming and everyone made me feel as if I wasn't a first-year pro, in effect.
And what were your... You sort of mentioned those Toulouse matches, which I still think have definitely been sort of replayed through lockdown. What are your sort of... The matches that really stick out for you from that Edinburgh time?
Yeah, those obviously stick out because they were really early in my days of Edinburgh. Mm. So those Toulouse games, I mean, playing, bear in mind, I've been playing Uni Rugby a year and a half ago, previous to that, and then I've been playing Toulouse in the quarterfinals, you know, against the likes of Intermac and Jean, you know, Vincent Clerc, Poitrineau, all these guys yeah. have been legends of French rugby probably for 5, 6, 7 years previous to that as well. Dominici, all these guys, Fabien Pelouse. You know, it was a serious Christian beat as well, I remember, just a massive number 8. But it was that sort of team that, you know, playing against, you're playing the football stadium because they obviously wanted to get more crowd in. And, 33,000, 34,000 in Toulouse watching that game, absolutely jam packed. And you're thinking, "Gee, this is proper. This is proper." I've been playing uni games in front of 100 people and a year and a half ago, and here I am. And that culminated, you know, that season obviously led to my first Scotland cap at the end of that year on the summer tour. So it was just a whirlwind sort of 12, 18 months, and you know, the opportunity came from. Unfortunate circumstances on the Scotland tour with injuries to probably 3 people ahead of me. That's basically how I got my chance initially, but
right.
when you get your chance, you know, you have to take it, and that's luckily what happened in that, you know, Australia game.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just looking back at that tour, it sort of seemed as if it was a bit of a throwback. Like, you played some sort of midweek games and that sort of thing. Did it still have that sort of amateur feel to it? It's like, I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, no, I don't think it had an amateur feel in the way the tour, I mean, the tour was very, very professional. I think the games, all the movement from place to place, you know, everything had been mapped out as if it was a professional outfit, and I mean, it was a professional outfit, but so I wouldn't say it in that way. The only thing I would say that is different is it was 6 weeks long. Mm. These days, as you know, tours aren't anything longer than 2 weeks, so it was 6 weeks long. We did play midweek games. I was playing on the Thursday night, Tuesday night, sorry, against New South Wales Country, because effectively we were in the Dirt Trackers side. I went on tour as probably the 45th player to go on. Bear in mind, there was 40, 45 players in the first place that went.
Yeah.
Whereas now you're looking at, what, 26 max? I don't know what the numbers are now on tour.
Sure.
But I can't even... 26, I would say 28 maybe. But there was 45 people on tour, and I can assure you, I probably would have been full this guy out of the hat. and, you know, just to make it on the tour was amazing. But I was playing against New South Wales Country in Wollongong for the Dirt Trackers on the Tuesday night in the St George Illawarra Stadium.
Yeah.
And, you know, amazing stadium, backed onto the sea. And obviously planning the night out afterwards, until I got a call at half time, right, Hugo, you've got to come off. Or I think it was 60 minutes, actually. You've got to come off because Tom Phillips gone down on the beach during the day or during the afternoon.
Jeez.
Playing touch rugby in Stones Crucia. And I'm thinking, this is bizarre. I already had my head in the pub in Wollongong somewhere.
Yeah.
But instead, I was whisked off somewhere to, because obviously the first team were playing Samoa in Wellington on the Friday night.
Yeah,
this was Wollongong on the Tuesday night in Australia. So I don't know if I flew that. I don't think I did because the game was in the evening. But I flew the next morning, arrived in Wellington, and obviously was straight onto the bench and took Tom Phillips' place on the bench.
Mm.
The game obviously on the Friday night in Wellington. I'm not sure how much you remember of it, but. Mossy obviously was playing fullback. Simon Webster was on the wing, and Simon Webster, I went on for Simon Webster probably after about 30 minutes as a blood replacement, and on the left wing. And Gordon Ross was playing 10 in the game, and I took an inside ball off Gordon Ross after that was my first touch, and right in the bread basket through a hole. I mean, you know, my eyes lit up. I was like, this is it. First touch in Test Rugby.
Yeah.
Spilled the ball. Spilled the ball straight in the bread basket. And I was like, right. And then look to the touchline, they're signing Webster ready to come back on from his bloody nose. So I'm like, this could actually be my only touch in terms of it. Lo and behold, Mossy then, half an hour before the end of the game, fractures his cheekbone. Poor Mossy.
Jeez.
Bear in mind, in the first game of the tour against the Queens and the Reds, Robbie Kidd had fractured his cheekbone as well. So I'd gone from 45th on the tour to replacing Tom Phillip on the substitutes bench for the Samoa test, to Mossy then going down in the game, fracturing his cheekbone and being out for the tour. Robbie Kidd had already been, he was second choice fullback, had already been fractured cheekbone off the tour. So suddenly I found myself, and luckily the last half an hour went pretty well against Samoa. So as you remember, we won 32-3 or something. So
yeah.
So ended up starting against Australia. When I say, you know, luck played its part in the start of my career, that is literally how it unfolded. And my unfortunate situation with other people led to my first couple of caps, and then, you know, it's about grasping it from there. And in some ways I did that, other times it was a struggle, but obviously there was some good times in there as well.
And what do you remember from that, particularly that first start versus Australia? I mean, that you look at the Australian team and they've got like a back three of Takiri, Wendell Saylor, Joe Roth, Larkham and Gregan, like that was a serious outfit.
Yeah, a serious outfit. And I guess the best thing about that weekend, and you talked about the sort of amateur era and whether that was a slightly more amateur tour. It wasn't necessarily amateur, but you did more stuff. You explored the country more. You went out to restaurants more. You had beers with your mates a bit more.
Yeah.
Within reason, obviously. But that weekend around my first cap was summed up with how things were. You know, it was the Queen's birthday that weekend of that Test match. So on the Friday, we were playing at the Telstra Dome in Melbourne, the first Test. And on the Friday, Saturday, was it the Friday? Sorry, Friday, Sunday, Monday, there was Aussie Rules football.
Mm-hmm.
So on the Friday night before the test, which I'm not sure would quite be the same situation now, we were all at the Telstra Dome watching, it might be actually, if it was that close, but we were watching, I think it was Carlton against Hawthorn, which obviously was a pretty tasty Aussie Rules, I think it was a local derby even. And so we watched that on the Friday night, and then obviously we played a test match on the Saturday. It was full on the Friday night, it was full on the Saturday, it was then full on the Sunday and the Monday. So you can imagine the festival of rugby and Aussie Rules that was going on that weekend. So all I remember is just that wherever you went in Melbourne that weekend, there was an absolute buzz. I mean, bear in mind, Scotland, Australia at the time were, as you said, there was that back three alone, but they were a pretty useful outfit. And, you know, most Australian teams might have been thinking, you know, this is a Scotland team coming over here with, you know, trying to win a game, but actually, how much hope is there that they will actually win? I think, you know, we were trying to compete. We didn't think that we wanted to win, obviously, but let's be realistic about the situation. They were a much better side than us on paper.
Mm.
And, I mean, what an experience. That game lives long in my memory. I mean, not only did I almost got completely KO'd by showing my head where I shouldn't have done, tackling Wendell Saylor. but also, I remember a moment, and this was the confidence of someone who probably hadn't experienced too much in international rugby before. I got the ball on, I think it was about, when I was about 45 metres out, and I thought it was really early in the game. I thought to myself, well, why not? Let's have a pop at a drop goal. It wasn't quite on here, and it ended up landing from, I probably kicked it from 45 metres, landed on the 22 in one of my center's arms.
Oh, jeez.
I don't think my forwards were too happy with me. to that day, since then, I don't think I've tried another drop goal in my international career. But an amazing experience. I mean, what a brilliant place to play rugby. Australia is a phenomenal place to play. Brilliant place to the training and everything building up to that game. I mean, it was probably one of the best places, you know, anywhere in Australia to get your debut. It was an amazing feeling. The full crowd, brilliant atmosphere, and obviously the whole weekend was just buzzing in Melbourne.
Yeah, definitely. I'm currently sort of trying to find a YouTube stream of that match, but to find that drop kick. But I think you might be saved. I don't think I can find it at the moment.
Yeah, no, I'd probably ask them to delete it.
That tour under Matt Williams?
It was under Matt Williams. Yeah, that was. I think that was
But, yeah.
Probably one of Matt Williams' first tours.
What was your experience of him as a coach? So obviously, he's sort of gone down as a, you know, not the best period for Scottish rugby.
Some of the people around Matt weren't ideal. I mean, we'd have a good laugh and a joke, quite a few of us, after Matt had left, and some of the guys, Willie Anderson and Brett Igo, who was the video guy, and sort of tended to take on a bigger role as things went on. But I mean, I think the people around him as well probably clouded things for him. My experience with Matt wasn't too bad, but obviously his record. I mean, I didn't get much out of him when he started playing me at 12. That's safe to say, completely out of position. Someone I'd never played before, but he said, "Oh, you know, I want to get you on the pitch. I'm going to play you at 12." And I was like, "Well, thanks very much." I remember one game playing at 12, and obviously normally running into sevens when you're playing 12 off the back of a line out, and I remember getting a dead leg, which I will never forget, from Mario Bergamasco against Italy.
Jeez.
Which kept me out. Luckily, it was in one of the breaks of the Six Nations, but I remember wearing a pad, like a plastic casing on my leg, underneath, you know, which is probably totally illegal. But I had to put it on there just to be able to get out on the pitch, in case he took another hit. But I had that on for like 4 weeks, feeling so much pain. So that was my experience of playing at 12, just running into sevens all day, and people like Mario Bergamasco are not ideal.
Jeez. And then Frank Handham was next in the hot seat for Scotland. It seems like sort of you were quite a regular pick under him. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I played. I was fortunate that I played under Frank at Edinburgh, and he had signed me, having been on trial there, and obviously I've been through, the good times with him at Edinburgh when we were playing well, and you know, I'd had a good start to my career at Edinburgh, and so that, I suppose, that put me in a position where he knew me as a player, he knew what I could do, and you know, there was a certain trust there. Yeah, I mean, we had some, as you know, some great victories under Frank. Especially against England, and those, you know, stand out beyond anything else in the memory of the period. You know, 2006, 2010, we obviously didn't lose at Murrayfield. You know, winning twice I know obviously one of them wasn't him, but 2006, 2008, and then obviously drew in 2010. So it was, that in itself is a pretty good record. Yes, there was other results as well that were good, and there was plenty that weren't so good. But you know, that period under Frank, I suppose he knew quite a lot of the guys in the team. He'd coached a lot of them at Edinburgh. He'd probably coached a lot of them yet when they were younger as well. So the difficult thing is, as a coach, is that, you know, you always go through, we always talk about this, you always go through a honeymoon period. And sustaining that honeymoon period, it almost shows you how good a coach is, because that sort of shows everyone the management skills as well. It's not just about being a brilliant coach, because coaches have other coaches around them that are just as good. So it's about your man management and about how you treat every single individual. And, you know, that's where a lot of coaches, I suppose, since Frank, have become unstuck. They might be good coaches, but their man management skills have let them down.
Sure. I mean, was there a sense that, you know, during that period where you played most of your rugby for Scotland, that, you know, you were always almost on the brink of, you know, greater success? You know, it seemed whenever a new coach came in, like when Frank Haddon came in, and you beat France and drew with England that year, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we won three games that year, so we lost, probably beat Italy that year as well.
Yeah.
So was that 2006, I think?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. But do you think you guys kind of felt like you were on the cusp of something?
We were very close. I mean, let's be honest, we're still very close. And, you know, Scotland has always been a team that on their day could perform and beat pretty much anyone. I mean, again, probably bar the All Blacks, who performance wise, I know we came close a few years ago, but on our day, we could pretty much beat everyone in any era that you go back to. The problem that we've had over is one, keeping the best players available on the pitch at any one time. So, we haven't had a huge pool of, it's not like we've got 30, 40 players. Obviously, it's getting there now. We're getting more depth around now with the quality of players coming through. But in the day, we had a pool probably of 25 players, 30 players, maybe maximum that we needed. And if you had any injuries, you were always up against it. And I think I'm not defending that against our consistency of performance, because that has always been an issue in Scottish rugby. On the day, we can beat anyone, we can put in a mass performance, the hopes rise, and then obviously it's flat the next week. And that is very difficult to sort of explain. To this day, I still, it wasn't like we weren't trying any harder one game. It wasn't like we mentally were off it. It's just sometimes that, we consistency of performance in Scottish rugby has not been, good enough. Not good enough, but has needed to improve for a number of years. And we're still there, I guess. We're still winning some amazing games. And then, we're losing again games we should win. So until we can hit those heights of consistency, it's always going to be a sort of nearly moment in Scottish rugby. And I thought we'd gone beyond that very recently, but then a couple of bad performances came. So I'm hoping, the team we've got at the moment and the squad we've put together and Greg has put together, there's every hope and there's every chance that this team can start to consistently.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Perform at a level where everyone can get excited. It's just frustrating that it hasn't been able to happen just yet.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, do you still keep a close eye on things? Do you watch a lot of rugby?
Yeah, no, I still do. Quite a bit of commentary. So I didn't mention that earlier, but I do obviously Pro 14. Probably one or two games a month, and I do a bit of. I was due to do the Edinburgh Bordeaux quarterfinal,
right?
In the Challenge Cup as well for BT. So I'm still doing a bit of stuff. Obviously, the other side of work keeps me pretty busy, so it doesn't allow me to do as much as maybe I'd like. But I still very much enjoy watching stuff and keeping a close eye on things. And obviously worked at Murrayfield during the Six Nations, so I was there. I saw what the guys are capable of, what they can do. As always, everyone wants and everyone wishes for that it just can happen on a more consistent basis. Not necessarily the results, because we're going to get beaten by teams that there's some good teams out there. But I suppose it's that consistency of performance that everyone, just fans, but players, coaches, will be striving for.
For sure. I suppose going back to your club career, you moved away from Edinburgh in 2009. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, 2009.
What was the driving force behind that at the time?
I think at the time I'd been in Edinburgh for 7 or 8 years. I felt that if I didn't move, you could get to the stage in your career where two things really. It was a challenge of moving somewhere else, and also the opportunity came. I was in the Six Nations February 2009, Six Nations, I was showing a room with Simon Taylor. And Simon Taylor was obviously at San Francisco at the time. And he mentioned to me that Ignacio Corletto, who obviously was the fullback for Argentina, but also fullback for Stanford Newcastle State at the time as well, had fallen out with Max, the owner. And we all know that you don't really want to fall out with Max if you play at Stade Francais. Well, that's exactly what Corletto had done. He'd got injured, he'd returned to Argentina, and he decided that he wasn't coming back until things had been patched up. But he was obviously getting rehab in Argentina as well, which had gone against the club's requests.
Right.
So this was a situation. They hadn't yet announced it, but obviously Simon had the inside knowledge that was the case, and he said to me, "I know that they're on the lookout for a fallback there, but they haven't officially raised this as a situation yet." So at the time, Ewan McKenzie, who was the ex-Australian prop, was the coach, and so my agent got in touch with him, and it seemed like with what I said about, you know, needing potential change to sort of to give my career hopefully a second push as such at that stage of what, sorry, 29, I think it was at the time. I thought, right, well, here's an opportunity. If I don't look and see what the what the situation is here, I might regret it. And so obviously my agent spoke to Ewan McKenzie. I went over there, had a chat with him, the other fullback at the time, Nick Jean, who was also sort of there or thereabouts in the French squad. So I had a chat to Ewan McKenzie, and obviously he did his very, very Australian proper research, you know, wanted everything from speed times, which I tried to shield away from him. He wanted, you know, everything from the last 2 years of international games. He wasn't interested in club games, so I sent those over to him. He studied them, he fired questions back to me, and in the end, he decided that he would sign me, and that was, you know, ironically, he signed me, but I never played for him. He got sacked before the end of that season, and so I was I actually signed, when I signed for Stade, I think it was April or May, he was still there at the club, but then he left in June. So I signed for him, but I've never played under him. And my right. first coach was Jack Delmas.
Okay.
Who was slightly different to Ewan McKenzie, I'll put it that way. I've never seen someone who can ridicule James Haskell as much as he did in a game away at Montpellier, telling him that he was going to rip up his contract in French. And Ben Kayser, who obviously spoke English and French, had to translate to Haskell, saying that if you ever had a game like that again, his contract was going to be ripped up.
Jeez.
Which was interesting, because you don't get much of that in front of people in UK, but in France, that happens.
And and who was sort of in that? You mentioned Haskell there. Who else was in that Stade Francais side? Because it seems like they always sort of, you know, build a team of almost Galacticos these days.
Yeah, well, at the time, so I guess overseas players. I mean, we had so French players. We had Dimitri Zarzewski, we had Julien Dupuy, we had Lionel Boxis, we had Sergio Parise, obviously Antoine Berbin, who obviously he's come into the French team over the last few years. We had, I'm just trying to think who else, Brian Liebenberg.
Yeah.
We had, and then we had, in terms of overseas players, we had Tom Palmer, obviously second row, who played for England. We had James Haskell. We had Ollie Phillips, who played on the wing, obviously sevens. We had Ignacio Mieres, who spent a bit of time over in the UK as well, playing for, I think, Worcester and Exeter.
Oh, yeah.
Played fly-half, Argentinian fly-half. We had Hernandez was there for a bit. Just trying to think. Obviously, Corletto left just before I signed. So yeah, there was a lot of players there. I mean, there was other guys. I would have, Marconnet was there at the time as well. There was guys, you know, quality Pascal Pape. I mean, there's the list goes on. The amount of players we had, and unfortunately, it was a time when the club was sort of struggling a bit in terms of the finances. Max was on the verge of sort of deciding whether he wanted to carry on, because, you know, his company in Alger wasn't quite doing as well as it had done in the past. So it was a difficult time for the club, but, you know, it was a good experience. And, you know, some of the players we had there, and Mark Gasnier as well was another quality player,
of course.
Who obviously a brilliant rugby league player in the day. So, you know, quality, and obviously Simon. So no, brilliant to play amongst those guys, and the experience, of the rugby. The life in Paris, we had our first child there. That was pretty testing and pretty difficult. And so I guess that side of it was tough, but I played, you know, 40 odd games in 2 years, and the experience of that, playing club games in front of, you know, 80,000 at the Stade de France against Toulon and Johnny Wilkinson and Clermont, and I mean, that is something you'll never forget. I mean, that atmosphere is as good as you'll get in any international. It was unbelievable.
Sounds absolutely incredible. I mean, how did you feel when, I don't know who the coach was at the time, but said, Hugo, you're playing scrum half against Bath in the Champions Cup. I've done my research. This is a great story.
I'll tell you what, I offered my services. I'll tell you what happened. We were, during the week, it was winter, very much winter. I mean, it was sort of December, January, I think, and it was, pre-Bath, and you'll remember the weather conditions of that game. Welcome to scrum half, thank you very much. It was absolutely horrendous. We were training in the week, because the weather was so bad, we were training in the week in a gym, in an indoor gym in the centre of Paris somewhere. And I looked around, and I hadn't heard on the Monday that, this was on the Tuesday, I think, but I hadn't heard on the Monday that one of our scrum halves, so one was Julien Dupuy, that was after we played Ulster, had been banned, if you remember, for that incident.
Yes, I do.
So he'd been banned for a long time. Noel Olshig, who was the other scrum half, had also been, I think he'd had a red card as well earlier, so he was banned as well. We then had another scrum half who was effectively cut tied because he'd signed, he wasn't registered for Heineken Cup. So I looked around and all three, and then one of our other scrum halves was injured. So we had four scrum halves, and so even the academy scrum half was injured. So I looked around and I suddenly saw Mathieu Blain, who was the hooker, practicing scrum half passing into a handball goal. Well, a handball goal, as you know, is not the smallest thing.
Yeah.
It's not like you're throwing it into, you're just practicing a scrum half passing into an ice hockey goal even, which is probably a third of the size. A handball goal is still pretty big. But he was obviously trying to just hit the target. And I went up to the coach and I said, I'm sorry, is Mathieu, you know, in French obviously, but is Mathieu looking to play scrum half this weekend? Because he hadn't announced the team yet. He said, well, he says, you know, he can probably almost act as another forward, almost like the Mauro Bergamasco situation. We know how that went. And bear in mind that Mathieu Blain's actually a hooker, not a flanker. I was thinking, well, this could go horribly pear-shaped.
Yeah.
It's an important game. We need to win. Very French just to go, yeah, why not? You just play hooker. You just play scrum half. You're a hooker. So I went up to the coach, Jack Delmas, looked at me, always looked completely perplexed every time you spoke to him, even though, you know, you thought you were speaking good French, because he refused to speak English.
Right.
He could speak it. And I said, I'm sorry, Jack, but I need to put my name forward to play scrum half, because I've played there till I was 15, 16. I said, I can't be watching what's going on here and not suggest that I can play.
Yeah.
And in the end, a few other guys went up to him, a few of the backs especially went up to him, Mark Gasnier, and said, yeah, I think we really need to make this happen. So that's how it came about. And yeah, I mean, there was a few incidences in the game as well, obviously, which was just, I mean, Lionel Boxey's to a T. I remember passing the ball back. I don't know if you have seen the footage.
I was just about to ask you where he tried to punt the pass.
He tried to, you know, there'd been a game earlier in the season where I'd thrown the ball into Boxies in a top 14 game, and rather than catch it, when I was straight into his hands, it was a quick 5 metre line out, instead of catch it, he just volleyed it up to himself, and he volleyed it up to himself perfectly. He just couldn't be bothered. There was no one around him.
Yeah.
He just couldn't be bothered to catch it. So he volleyed it up into his hands. Looked pretty cool, but if it goes wrong, you look pretty stupid. But
yeah,
that was Lionel Boxey's complete and utter maverick, and hence he never really pushed on in his career, because as a player, you could either, you know, love him or hate him. He was one of those guys. But anyway, in that game, playing fly half, obviously slippery ball, Boxey's in the dead ball area, or on his line, pretty much on the goal line. I've passed the ball back to him. He's a bit lower than he would have liked, put it that way, but perfectly high enough to catch, but he decided to try and volley it. Obviously, completely missed it in the wet conditions. And Michael Klassens, who's playing scrum half with David Bath, just said thank you very much and ran under the post and passed on the ball and scored. So that was, how to be made to look even more stupid playing nine by Lionel Boxey's.
I'm actually just watching it now. I think your pass is absolutely fine. So I don't think it was your fault.
It might have been a bit slow and a bit loopy, but I think I could be excused in the weather conditions.
Yeah, definitely. So two years at Stade, and then at that point were you sort of looking to come back to the UK, or just sort of trying to assess options? Was a move back to Scotland ever on the cards?
A move back to Scotland wasn't on the cards, mainly because the option wasn't there. I'll be brutally honest. I'd you know done my time in Edinburgh. I mean, if an opportunity had come back to move to Edinburgh, then or even to Glasgow, I had spoken to Glasgow in my career about different times of coming back. So if an opportunity had arisen to come back, then I would have come back because it would have made things a lot easier moving forward for when we decided to come back up here, because we always planned and wanted as a family to move and live back up in Edinburgh. So that was the end goal. Obviously the situation forced me into, so if you remember, 2011 was World Cup year.
Yeah.
I was playing for Stade Français against Racing in May, pre-World Cup, and I did my knee. Not badly, but did my knee, and that's when I missed the Challenge Cup final the following week, which was against Quins, where we lost by a point at the Cardiff City Stadium. So I missed that game, which was pretty gutting in the first place. But obviously, that was after that Racing game at home, that was the end of my Stade career. But it hadn't been. I didn't think it was going to be the end during the Six Nations. So when we played France in Paris in February that year, before I left Stade Français, Michael Checker was obviously coach by this stage in my second year at Stade. I had more coaches at Stade than anyone can probably count on their fingers. But Michael Checker was coach in my second year. And when I went over to play for Scotland against France on the Friday, he said, well, why don't we just meet up for a coffee? So I went out for a coffee with him and chatted things through. And he, you know, said to me, I've been thinking things through, and you know, as I said before, I really want to keep you on for another year on the same terms. And I was like, yep, great, fine. Let's just do it for another year. Just solves things. There was a few options, but because it was World Cup year, it was a really, really difficult time to sort out the next career move, because it was always going to be difficult, because you wouldn't have been back with your new club until October.
Yeah.
That's what I decided to do. And then I had a call after the Six Nations, and probably not down to performance, but just because of situations changing. Stade Français suddenly were in desperate need of a 10. In order to accommodate a 10, they needed to lessen their... it's not like I was on loads of money, but they needed to balance the books in terms of making more money available for a 10 and bring in a lesser experienced 15. And so suddenly what had been discussed about wasn't even brought back to me by Michael Checker, but instead was brought to my attention by a French agent who then passed it on to say that was the case.
Right.
To this day, I never ever heard from Michael Checker, pretty much from that time that I played in that last game. I think he let me know actually after that last game. The agent let me know after that last game, but Checker never spoke to me after that game again.
Jeez.
Because he couldn't face the fact of having changed his mind. He couldn't bring himself to tell it to me myself in person. And so that was, and I found it quite interesting. If you read Bernard Jackman's book about Michael Checker, it gives you quite an insight into the guy. You might come across as, well, you've seen him in the coach's box. That's how he can be. He's in person a lovely bloke, but gee, there's definitely two sides to Michael Checker.
That's really interesting, because he kind of paints a picture of himself as like a very principled, straightforward, almost like good old-fashioned honest bloke, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, there's I think you can speak to many people about Michael Checker, and you know, he's in person, you know, off the rugby field, a good guy, but you know, you've got to be, as a coach, as people have experienced, as I'm sure he's even learned it himself, you've got to be honest, you've got to be straight with your players, you've got to, you know, you do whatever you can to make sure that everyone's as happy as they can be. Not everyone's going to be happy the whole time, If you change your mind, something changes, you're just honest, you go to the player and you say, I'm really sorry, this is the situation. He couldn't bring himself to do that, so it left a bit of a bad taste. And it put me in a position as well where going to a World Cup, potentially injured, not sure whether I would make the World Cup squad because I was injured, and I would only be fit 2 weeks before. At the time, I was second choice behind Mossy, so there was always this doubt in my head. I was 31, obviously, at the time as well. Mm. So that was partly the reason at the end of that Six Nations why I had a discussion with Andy Robinson pre-World Cup, and I said, Andy, this is very important to the next stage. If I go to the World Cup, I need to have some sort of inkling whether you're thinking of taking me to this World Cup, because otherwise I'm going to slog my guts out to try and get fit. I might get fit a week before and you then say, right, I'm going to take you. But if you then say you're not going to take me, I've then got to go out, for clubs are not going to sign me because they don't know whether I'm going to the World Cup until October.
Yeah.
And ultimately, at the time, it wasn't like, you know, Scotland, it was brilliant. Obviously, had an amazing career with Scotland, but I was thinking, I'm 31 here, I've got two kids. Mm. I said, if I've got your main job, obviously, and what you get paid for is your club.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was seriously concerned that if I went to the or trained and then didn't make the squad, or if I didn't even get fit, then I wouldn't have a club until potentially, you know, October time. So I decided to speak to Andy about it. I said, I'm in a really difficult position now. I've been offered a contract, or I've been offered a couple of deals based on not going. He said, I can't give you any clue because everyone's in the same boat, everyone's training artists. And I said, that's absolutely fine, but I've got a big decision to make here. It was a shame because, you know, I wasn't in any way ready to give up. But what if I went to the World Cup, didn't play, and I couldn't get a contract at the end? That was the thought going through my head, and I was still only 31, and I still felt I had a lot to give. So it was a tough decision, but, you know, I mean, I look back on the career, you know, the amount of times I played, and, you know, I played 59 times in out of 63 tests. So I missed four tests in 7 years. Mm. And, you know, I gave as much as I could give, and I loved every minute of it. So I don't look back on it with regret that I didn't make a second World Cup. I played in 2007. And at the time, that was the best decision for me and my family. And that's why I took it.
And who was the coach at Wasp at the time? Who brought you over?
So Di Young. I was Di Young's first signing.
Oh, right, wow.
He effectively signed at the same time that I signed. I mean, he came in and he signed me. I was signed, obviously, late in the day because I didn't sign, I don't think, for Wasp until sort of middle of June, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe later, even July. So it was pretty late in the day, but I was his, and so I had a good, you know, good relationship with him. I knew that he'd come in to sort of build something, and the fact that I was the first guy that he brought on to start that build, was a good feeling. And obviously after year one, then, I was captain in year two. So, you know, I had a great time at Wasp. I've had a great time for different reasons at all the clubs I've been to. Mm. Obviously, you know, both Edinburgh and Wasp have a special place, you know, in the two respective leagues I've played in the UK. A great experience, and I enjoyed it. But I wouldn't say I would rush back to play in front after my experience at Stad. People have different experiences at different clubs, but the all round experience at Stad was okay.
Right.
I enjoyed the rugby, but outside of it, it was pretty tough. But Edinburgh, hence I'm back in Edinburgh now. Edinburgh is a great, brilliant place. Absolutely love it. Brilliant teammates I had through my time. Wasp likewise. You know, I've been back down there regularly since retiring. You know, so really good memories from those two clubs, especially. And you know, I wouldn't have changed many things apart from obviously more consistent winning performances for Scotland.
One of the questions that we got on Twitter was, I think on quite a few places online say that you were sort of, as you mentioned, cricket was a big, big love of yours, and you sort of wanted to be a dual internationalist for Scotland. Would, Would you sacrifice, you know, say a portion of your Scotland caps to have achieved that?
I took the cricket. I tried to be a pro cricketer when I was 19, 20. I didn't quite make it. Yes, I look back at it at the time and think, you know, what if I'd gone to another county and tried my luck at the time? You know, Sussex was quite a strong county, and maybe I could have, you know, gone somewhere else. I won't mention some of the other counties I could have gone to, but I could have gone somewhere else maybe and gone on trial there. But, you know, again, 18, 19 year old, a bit sort of, I guess, a bit frustrated with how things had worked out. Decided not to pursue that, and actually, I wouldn't change anything. I mean, I had the most, you know, the best time. Yes, there's some difficult times throughout my career, as everyone and anyone in a Scotland shirt would have been through. But you know, I wouldn't change it for anything. And to be a dual international, I mean, I tried to play a bit of cricket after I finished playing, and obviously, you know, we won the league with Carlton in 2016, and, you know, had a good year. Played for East of Scotland and scored a couple of 50s, I think, for them. And, you know, if the opportunity was there, then it would have come probably then, rather than sort of me forfeiting a portion of my rugby career to try and make it. So, you know, I was probably still, you know, I still would have had an opportunity at 35, 36 when I was playing for Carlton to probably play, but, you know, who's going to want a 35 to 36 year old to play the cricket for Scotland? And I think you're looking at 21, 22 year olds rather than 35, 36 year olds.
Yeah, sure. Maybe just sort of rounding off everything, what was your favourite Scotland match that you sort of look back on fondly?
I can't look much beyond. I mean, obviously my first cap, you know, first cap and first start. I mean, it all sort of rolled into one for me. I got half an hour off the bench against Samoa in Wellington. But that was pretty subdued because it was obviously Samoa in Wellington. The crowd wasn't that big, and it was just a bit, all a bit surreal, the whole sort of how things have unfolded. So I always sort of think of Australia as my first proper start, even though it was my second cap. So that for me was just immense. And also the occasion, as I said earlier in this conversation, to match that. So that was amazing. But you can't ignore, irrespective of how the games might have looked on TV in the pouring rain against England, you can never beat a Calcutta Cup win.
Sure.
And, you know, that those two wins in 2006 and 2008, no matter how they came, whether it was because of, you know, big hits from Jace or Simon Taylor, or, you know, our defence being absolutely outstanding, whatever way they come, those wins, as we've seen over the years, don't come around that often. So you have to treasure those. So those 2006, 2008 Calcutta Cup wins will live long in the memory.
Yeah, definitely. I still think, you know, loads of fans look back on them, you know, with really great memories. What about the best player that you've played with and against?
I know it's probably, you've probably heard this so many times. I would say in his prime, the best player I've played against, and he's not in my position, but just at reading the game, was Dan Carter. And, it, and sure. Everyone's going to say that it's Dan Carter. I mean, you talk about all sports, and you talk about people's time on the ball, and you talk about people in international rugby. People go, "Oh, he's got loads of time on the ball. What's he doing? Why is he not passing it? Why is he still holding onto the ball?" I mean, it's amazing how quickly defences come up on you. Dan Carter seemed to have an extra 3 or 4 seconds to everyone else on the pitch, and his decision making at the line, whether it was to pass before the tackle, to pass the other side of the tackle, you know, and having the ability to do that as well, his all-round game, his kicking game, when to kick, when to cross-field kick, you know, it was pretty remarkable. I mean, the other guy as well that I really struggled with in my first first start against Australia was Stephen Larkham.
Sure.
And that's because he had the most ridiculous banana kick I've ever seen. So he could run one way and kick it the other way with distance, which I don't think I've ever seen anyone else be able to do since that. And what that did as the fullback meant you were running 60-meter sprints back and across and back the pitch the whole time, because you're second guessing which way he was going to kick it. And so for me, that didn't make him the best player, but it made him a player that was very difficult as a fullback to defend against the kicking game. So for that, his kicking game was probably one of the best in the world at the time. But Dan Carter is an all-round player, just for his ability and his time on the ball, that made everyone look as he had 3 or 4 more seconds to everyone else.
And what about teammates of yours?
Teammates of mine. I mean, I've played with some brilliant players, I would guess the best all round athlete player probably had the privilege of playing with. And saying this, he didn't play as well for Stade Français as he did for Italy, but Sergio Parisse. Obviously, his caps speak for themselves for Italy. But in terms of his level of performance, in terms of consistency over God knows how many years he played both for Stade Français and for Italy, was absolutely phenomenal. Mm. And he was in, he was in brilliant shape, a phenomenal nick for a whole stage of his career. Wasn't injured that often. Yes, he had a few knee injuries, but he wasn't too badly injured. Could pretty much do everything. I mean, he could drop kick. He could, not that he needed to. He could punt for touch. He could do everything. Again, decision making off the base of the scrum, acceleration away. I mean, he was properly good, especially in his prime. Yes, okay, towards the end of his career, things might have slowed down a bit. But gee, what a longevity of a career and a very very proper amazing player.
Definitely, that's fascinating. And then, probably the last question is just, through this period of sort of isolation and everything, which former teammate would you sort of most and least like to sort of spend lockdown with?
I definitely like to, the person I'd least like to spend lockdown with is James Haskell.
Okay.
I think a few people have probably. I did a quiz the other night, university quiz, and Chris Robshaw came on as a surprised guest to ask one of the questions, and he said as well. He said, "Who's the person I'd least like to be stuck in a room with for too long, or something like that, or stuck in a lift with?" And it was Haskell.
Right.
So I think he probably gets that quite a bit. So Haskell is the person I'd least like to be. Stuck in lockdown with. In terms of the person, I mean, there's quite a few guys. I mean, I as I say, a lot of my Edinburgh teammates, were all, quality blokes that I had a really good team spirit, not just on the pitch, as a group of players, but obviously off the pitch as well. And, those times I spoke about in 2003, 2004, I think it's hard to say, as any one individual that I would like to get stuck in lockdown with. I think as a group, the relationship we had as players, Edinburgh especially, because I was there the longest, was absolutely amazing.
Awesome. Well, Hugo, thanks so much for that. That's been absolutely brilliant.
No problem at all.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at libertymutualcareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.